Hello, and welcome to Viewpoints, soon to be called Eyes on Success, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman Torpy and Peter Torpy.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. This week on Viewpoints, we'll be talking with Mitch Pomerantz, president of the American Council of the Blind.
We'll learn about the ACB, its mission, its history, and some of the advocacy work they do to improve the lives of visually impaired people. We'll also hear about ACB radio with programming by and for people with vision loss. But first, for our tip of the week. This week's tip comes from Mitch Pomerantz.
A lot of people aren't learning Braille anymore, are they?
Unfortunately, and it's a tragedy because it's how we communicate. And I can't imagine not being able to make a note to myself. I am an experiential learner, and I have to use Braille every day. I take notes. I have a Braille writer sitting just off my left shoulder on my desk. I take down numbers with it, messages with it. I'm about to start the process of learning to use BrailleSense U2 that I bought at our convention this past July because I have to have Braille with me. I know lots of people do everything orally off the computer, and I certainly use a computer, not super well, but I use the computer, but I have to actually read something. And, I think we have done a terrible disservice to the last really two generations of blind and visually impaired youth by not pushing harder for them to learn Braille. Technology is wonderful, but it's not the be-all and end-all. And if you can't make a note to yourself in a medium that you can readily access and understand, you're behind the eight ball.
And as good as our access has become these days with speech synthesizers, audio recordings, screen readers, and the like, Braille can be an important adjunct for taking notes, for multitasking while you're listening in a meeting, and it can be an important tool. The more tools we have at our disposal, the better off we are.
Even just for little things like knowing what time it is without disrupting everyone else in the room with a talking watch. Turning now to our low-tech item, let's meet Mitch Pomerantz. Can you start by introducing yourself?
My name is Mitch Pomerantz, and I'm the president of the American Council of the Blind.
When we set up this interview, you told us you were retired. That doesn't sound like you're fully retired.
Well, I'm retired from paid employment. I worked for the City of Los Angeles for 2 months shy of 34 years. I worked in human resources for the first 20 or so, and in the last 13 and a half, I was our Americans with Disabilities Act compliance officer. So I retired New Year's Eve of 2008, and I was already ACB president. I'd been elected in July of 2007, so I had two careers that I was juggling for a year and a half. But I've been working or volunteering full-time for ACB since the end of 2008.
And do you have a visual impairment yourself?
I am basically totally blind. I've got a little bit of light perception, but not enough to even get me in trouble. So I am totally blind.
And what's the cause of that?
I had childhood glaucoma back in the 50s, and then I had cataracts and then scar tissue.
So did you have some vision as a child?
I did. I could see colors. I could read medium-sized newsprint. They almost put me into a sight-saving class in, I think, third grade. I didn't quite see well enough for that, but I did have quite a bit of vision when I was a child.
When you say a sight-saving class, what do you mean?
What that meant back then is that you were in a class where large print and not Braille was emphasized. A lot of kids who were in sight-saving class for a period of time and then had their vision deteriorate, unfortunately, really lost out because Braille was not taught, and those kids really ended up being on the short end of the stick in terms of learning Braille and becoming comfortable with Braille. Luckily for me, and I did not have enough vision to get into that class, and so continued to master my Braille skills.
So these sight-saving classes, were they part of the regular public school, or were they a separate school for the visually impaired?
I went to what is now and has been for many years, although I fear we're going to lose it, the last remaining K through 6 elementary school for blind and visually impaired students. It's called Frances Blend School. She was an educator in the early 20th century who was very much involved in teaching blind children. And this school has been around for now about 100 years. Most of the classes were for blind children, and in those days, most of us only had the singular disability of blindness. But then there was the one, quote-unquote, sight-saving class, and in talking to other folks, I understand that those classes were fairly popular around the country, but perhaps not so much anymore with mainstreaming and so on.
You know, I had a very similar situation to yours. I was born with congenital glaucoma in the early 50s also. I could see by holding a print book a few inches from my nose, although I couldn't see the blackboard from the front of the room in a public school, so I did go to a school for the blind. They did teach me Braille there, but when they found out that I was reading many of my books from the public library in print, they got very annoyed at that. But in retrospect, you know, I think for myself and many of the people we talk to, it's so important to learn Braille when you're young, especially if you suspect that your sight may deteriorate at a later date.
I was very lucky because I was initially a fairly reluctant Braille reader. It wasn't that I didn't feel I needed it or that I was facile with print. It really had to be fairly large newsprint for me to read it. But I was lucky that my mother was a supremely gifted nag and really pushed me into reading Braille. And when I finally decided that that was what I needed to do, I became a really pretty fast Braille reader. I used to drive my teachers crazy because I ended up being a one-finger, one-handed Braille reader. And I still read probably as fast as most folks do, but I never was comfortable reading with two hands. And they finally gave up on me, I think, and realized that that was how I was going to read, and that was the way it was.
You are listening to Viewpoint.
This week's focus topic is the American Council of the Blind, and we're going to let Mitch tell us all about it.
I thought maybe you could tell us a little bit about the history of the American Council of the Blind and a bit about its mission.
Surely. The organized blind movement really began in nationally in 1940 when the National Federation of the Blind was founded. Beginning in the mid-1950s, there began to be a clear difference of opinion and difference of philosophy in terms of how the Federation should be managed. The leadership of the Federation at that time was very strong, and I think the easiest, simplest way to describe it was very top-down. A number of people within the NFB at that time objected to that. And while they made efforts throughout the 50s to reform the NFB, it became clear that that wasn't possible. In 1961, a group of folks walked out of the NFB convention in Kansas City, Missouri, walked across the street, and in an adjacent hotel decided to establish the American Council of the Blind. And we have now been in existence for 51 years. ACB is very much a grassroots consumer advocacy organization. Yes, I'm the president, and yes, we have a board of directors. But the policies, the advocacy direction that this organization takes is predicated on the actions of the membership through our national conventions each summer, through resolutions which the members bring to us and have to be voted upon by the membership. We have 70 state and special interest affiliates. Actually, it's probably, I think, now 71. We are in almost every state in the union. I think we're in 46 states. And then we have what are called special interest affiliates. For example, we have a teacher's affiliate, a lawyer's affiliate, a student affiliate. The state affiliates are quite autonomous. We do not dictate what direction they take in their own home state, which is a good thing because my wife Donna is the president of our California affiliate. We have a small staff in Arlington, Virginia. Then we have an office in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, which handles the finances of ACB and also oversees the operation of 6 thrift stores, which provides some revenue to ACB. We've had the thrift store business since the early 1970s. Basically, the mission of ACB is to make the lives of blind and visually impaired persons better through advocacy, through peer support, through an ongoing scholarship program, and certainly because we're the type of organization we are, through the activities of our state and special interest affiliates.
About how many members do you have?
We have in the national organization somewhere around 15,000 members. But if you take our organization, if you take the NFB, and you throw in the blinded veterans, our membership really only comprises perhaps 1% of the overall blind population.
You talk about ACB doing a lot of advocacy work. Can you give some specific examples?
If you spend any time as a pedestrian, I mean, the way blind people learn to travel independently and to know when it's safe to cross streets is based on traffic patterns. And, you know, in the good old days, you could always hear a car coming along beside you, crossing your path. And so you were able, at least better able, to determine whether it was safe to cross. Well, that's not so much the case anymore. Not only have gasoline-powered engines become quieter, but then you have the influx of hybrid vehicles. So we felt, and I think, you know, it was one of those times when the entire blindness community realized that this was a problem for us, we needed to begin the process of establishing some minimum sound standards for hybrid vehicles. So the Pedestrian Safety Enhancement Act was passed in 2010, and it required the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, or NHTSA, to undertake development of minimum sound standards for hybrid vehicles. That report was supposed to have been completed in July of this year, and apparently it has. But it then went to the Government Accountability Office, where it is languishing in somebody's in-basket. We keep hearing rumors that that report is supposed to be released for public comment through the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking process, or NPRM process, any time now. So we are anxiously awaiting that report.
So this must be a real push and tug, because I would guess so many people are pushing to make cars quieter.
That is absolutely correct. There's been some pushback from folks that believe that we need a quieter world. And while I certainly, in theory, support the sentiment living in a big city, the reality is that we have got to be able to rely on sound emanating from moving vehicles, idling vehicles, for us to travel independently. Unless we want to see the day when everybody who is blind has to use paratransit, we have got to be able to hear what's going on in our environment.
And of course, we're now contributing to the problem. We bought a hybrid about 6 months ago, and when I put it into reverse, it beeps, but only inside the car.
So what other advocacy efforts is the ACB involved in these days?
I guess we'll begin with something that will be happening in early January. This past July, Congress passed and the President signed a bill that came out of the Food and Drug Administration that had to do with some necessary reauthorizations of some of their activities. Contained in that legislation was language that ACB had drafted, which calls for the establishment of a working group of persons who are blind and visually impaired, who are seniors, and who also represent the pharmaceutical industry, the major pharmacy chains around the country, to get together and establish best practices to provide information that sighted folks have routinely on prescription drug packages and on labels, to provide them in alternate formats for persons who are blind and visually impaired, be that Braille, be it large print, be it through some means of providing that information audibly. And that working group has been put together. I will be the representative from ACB, and we will begin the process of developing these best practices under the auspices of the United States Access Board. And ultimately, there will be a period where pharmacies will have an opportunity to pick and choose what their preferred method of providing materials for their blind and visually impaired customers will be. And then there will be some monitoring activities down the road. But ultimately, our goal is to make sure that persons who are blind and visually impaired, and that means by and large senior citizens, because most blind people, I think the percentage is something like 60-70%, are over the age of 60. And make sure that these people don't take the wrong prescription and don't overdose. ACB is very proud to have sponsored this legislation, this language that ended up getting passed and signed into law. And ultimately, what we're going to have will be prescription drug labeling on packages that anyone who is blind or visually impaired will be able to understand. And I think we'll save lives as a result of our advocacy efforts.
Boy, that does not seem like a piece of legislation that should have still been necessary. That's just something someone should have thought about a long time ago.
Well, yeah. You know, it's sometimes the obvious isn't obvious, but you know, that's why you need the American Council of the Blind. That's why you need these kinds of advocacy efforts, because blind and visually impaired people, we're really a small percentage even of the overall disability population. You know, out of sight, out of mind for the sighted. They don't necessarily have regular dealings with us. And if you don't think about it, if you don't have that kind of interaction with a blind person, you don't even realize that we're there, that we function in society, until and unless some member of the family begins to have some vision loss. Then all of a sudden it dawns on you, well, gee, what do we do? Do we have to take care of them for the rest of their lives? Are there homes for people like that? What do they do? Well, most of us want to be independent. We want to not be a burden on our families.
You told us all of these great services you provide and public awareness and lobbying and getting new laws enacted that you've already done. What plans does the ACB have for things coming up in the next year or two?
One of the things we're going to be doing 2013, we are going to be looking for sponsors, because the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, while they provide funding for persons who need orthotics and mobility aids, wheelchairs for folks with physical disabilities, they do not provide funding for persons who need things like closed-circuit televisions and bioptic lenses and monoculars for people who need those devices to remain independent. They have a lens limitation in the statute, and we believe that's discriminatory. So we are going to begin the process, and we know it's going to be a lengthy process, particularly because it's going to cost money. But we are beginning the process in 2013 to get CMS to at least establish a pilot project or a series of pilot projects across the country so that we can begin to establish the efficacy of providing this kind of equipment and this sort of these sorts of devices to persons who are blind or visually impaired so that they can remain in their homes rather than having to go to assisted living facilities because they can no longer read their mail, pay their bills, and function as we all do in society. So that's one initiative that we're very focused on for 2013 and beyond.
Oh, fabulous. I hope you're successful. That'll be a wonderful thing.
We do too.
But I could see some roadblocks.
So can we, and we're realists. But the one thing about our movement as blind and visually impaired persons, because we've been advocates for a very long time, we're a patient lot. And bureaucrats come and go, and elected leaders come and go, but we're going to be around. So we believe that even if it takes 5, 6, 8, 10 years, we will be successful.
In addition to advocacy and lobbying, the American Council of the Blind also provides useful information directly to the blind community.
We do have an internet radio station, ACB Radio, and we're honored to carry this program on ACB Radio. And through that website, acb.org and ACB Radio, folks can get more information about the American Council of the Blind, and I strongly encourage folks to do that.
Viewpoints airs every Wednesday evening starting at 10 p.m. Eastern Time and then repeats every 2 hours overnight and through the day on Thursdays. So you get lots of opportunities to listen to us, which is just so exciting. But in addition to us, they also provide this program worldwide to people who are blind or have low vision. And the programming that they have is all produced by blind programmers. And it's a platform on which blind musicians and artists and other people who, you know, talk about topics of interest to the blind can express themselves. How can people reach the American Council of the Blind if they want more information?
Folks can certainly contact the ACB National Office. Our phone number is area code 202-467-5081. Our website is www.acb.org. And folks who want to contact me directly as ACB president, it's Mitch, M-I-T-C-H, dot Pomerantz, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-T-Z, at earthlink.net. Everybody knows how to reach me. I get all kinds of emails, so that's perfectly fine. And that way I can direct them to the right place, to the right person.
Now for this week's high-tech item, the pros and the cons of using technology. It was bound to come down to a discussion of this. We almost always have some sort of high-tech topic in this segment. Well, now we're going to talk about whether or not it's worth using those.
So you've talked a little bit about the trade-off between using Braille versus things like speech synthesizers and other technology and how blind people can use them. And you talked about things like making the cars louder and crossing streets. And one might envision that a blind person could carry some kind of device that could sense a car. And maybe that would be another place where technology could impact how things are done. And I guess I was wondering if you had any comment on the use of technology and some of the trade-offs involved.
I'll give you a one-word answer. No, a two-word answer. Technology fails. I have seen posts about technology, about solutions where somebody is testing a device that would let a blind person know that there's a car coming, there is some obstacle in the way. But the problem is it's not foolproof. It's not 100%. And I would much rather, at least myself personally, rely on my own senses, those that remain, to determine whether it's safe for me to go somewhere than on technology. Look, technology is a wonderful thing. We've got friends who use GPS to make sure that they are on the right street or in the right area, and you know, they don't necessarily need to have the automatic annunciator on buses let them know when they're coming to their street. They use their GPS and that tells them that they're at their intersection to get off. But my response to people who use GPS for that is a trip that Donna and I took, and we were taking one of those blue super shuttle vans that use a GPS system to help the driver navigate from one stop to the next. And the GPS went on the blink. It was having the guy go in circles. It had totally gone haywire. And that's all you need to know about technology. It doesn't always work. And so if we only rely on technology to mitigate our blindness, then we are subject to the whims of that technology. So I believe that as blind people, we need to be as skilled, as knowledgeable in what we call the alternative techniques of blindness as we can be. And yeah, the technology can supplement those skills, but we should never allow those skills to degenerate to where the only way we can function is by using technology.
And I guess you always have to worry about the batteries running out.
Oh, absolutely. That's the easiest thing to go on a piece of technology.
Well, thank you, Mitch, for the opportunity to talk about the ACB and learn a little bit about that organization. So I also wanted to let our listeners know that, as usual, all the links and contact information will be in our show notes associated with this show. And we will continue to have the old website, www.viewpointsplus.net, active for listeners who are used to getting to us that way, but we are encouraging new listeners and advertising the new website, www.eyesonsuccess.net, for new listeners. They both point to the same place.
That's it for show number 1251. Next week on Viewpoints, we'll be having our year-end special and the final episode of Viewpoints before we change the name to Eyes on Success. We'll celebrate completing our second full year of hosting and producing Viewpoints. You can hear how we got started, a little bit of the history of the show, enjoy some tips and clips from people we've interviewed, along with notable show highlights from 2012, and a preview of exciting topics to be covered in Eyes on Success in 2013. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to contact@viewpointsplus.net or call us at 585-258-0333, and we'll try to address your question in an upcoming program.
You've been listening to Viewpoints, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman Torpey and Peter Torpey, and distributed by WXXI Reach Out Radio. For detailed information or a full archive of programs, visit www.viewpointsplus.net. You can also follow us on Facebook or Twitter at Viewpoints Plus. We hope you will join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. And remember, beginning in January, we'll have a new name, Eyes on Success.